It is well accepted that Jaws is an all-time great film, but its progeny don't rank nearly as high. Two True Freaks is proud to present Is It Jaws, where Paul Spitero and Sean Whalen are joined by an all-star list of guest hosts to review old and new films and place them on the Jaws scale, where they're ranked from Jaws to Jaws 4. Of course, for the purposes of the show, that scale does take some liberties with their actual ratings. Sure, movies that are given the ranking of Jaws are considered classic films with few flaws, if any. A ranking of Jaws 2 indicates that the film is very good and worthy of repeated viewings. A Jaws 3 ranking indicates the film was okay, but that's all. A Jaws 4 means it's ranked as a bad movie. Oh, and if you ever saw Back to the Future Part 2, you know that there's a Jaws 19. That ranking indicates that the movie is so incredibly bad that it's actually fun to watch as a result. So please join Paul and Sean as they ask the ever-important question, is it Jaws?
And the only man who can stop them.
I freeze. I'm Batman.
Can't do it alone.
Batman will watch his beloved Gotham perish.
Bundle up, boys. There's a storm coming.
Kill the heroes!
It's a hockey team from hell.
Cool party.
Arnold Schwarzenegger.
All right, everyone, chill.
George Clooney.
Julie, I'm not the marrying kind.
I know you've had your wild nights.
Good night. Wild doesn't quite cover it.
Chris O'Donnell.
I want a car. Chicks dig the car.
This is why Superman works alone.
Uma Thurman.
So many people to kill. So little time.
Alicia Silverstone.
And you are?
Batgirl.
That's not awfully PC. What about Batperson?
Found the Batcave.
She knows who we are.
Guess we'll just have to kill her.
Yep.
In a Joel Schumacher film. Strength. And courage.
Partners.
Honor.
Partners.
And loyalty. Partners. It all comes together.
We're going to need a bigger cave.
Batman and Robin.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Is It Yours? I'm Paul Spitero, and as always, I am joined by my good buddy, Mr. Sean Whalen.
It is terrific to be here, my friend.
Is it really? Is it really? Because you know what we're going to talk about.
It is. Still, it's good to see you.
Okay. And we are here today to talk about Batman and Robin. So I decided to torture my two friends from the Movie Film Podcast and invite Zaki Hassan and Brian over here. And how are you guys doing?
Doing very well. Thanks. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, happy to be back.
Now, it's a pleasure to have you guys, and I'm sorry to make you do this one. And I'm going to do a little housekeeping before we get into this one, because I was just thinking, you know, we've been going along. We started with Batman 66, and we're working our way through, I guess this would still be the Burtonverse. And I was thinking the next one we were going to do was Batman Begins, and then I started, you know, all of a sudden, you know, you hear the brakes squealing, and I'm thinking, should we do Mask of the Phantasm or the Batman, the Return of the Joker? You know, I was thinking maybe, and I'm going to leave that to you guys because you're the ones who I bother to schedule these things.
I'm down.
Yeah.
Right. Let's so be I'm thorough. Keep you on the hook so much longer before we find a new topic to discuss. Anyway, again, we're here to do Batman Returns from 1997. And Batman the and best way I could describe... What's that?
Batman and Robin,
excuse me. Yes, I'm sorry. I see I'm trying to wipe it out of my mind.
You're thinking of a better movie. Yeah,
yeah, wishful thinking.
I get it.
The best way I can think of describing this, what came to me is the first time I had Zachy on, we were talking about Planet of the Apes, and we went into a little talk about the Tim Burton Planet of the Apes. And the way he described it to me was, you know, I saw it and I wanted to like it so much that I kind of squinted and said, yeah, it was okay. And I think that's what I did. That's a very good description of what I did when I saw this in the movies in 1997. Since 1997, I have never sat from beginning to end and watched this entire movie. So it almost felt cartoon-like when I saw scenes from it. And it was like, you know, yeah, people are too harsh on this one. Until I sat down and watched it again from beginning to end to talk to you guys today. And then I'm thinking, well, maybe they're not quite so harsh. But that's my first impression, and we'll get more into detail, I'm sure. But Sean, how about you?
So I saw this movie opening night. I'm a Batman junkie. So, you know, he had me like a fish on a hook because it was more Batman. I kind of walked out of the last one with where the villains were going. You know, they got the last one, the villains started to get really over the top, really cartoony, and this doubled down on it. I'll talk more about it as we're talking, but actually last night I went through and rewatched it again for this, but with the Schumacher commentary. Which was really interesting to get his perspective on what was going on at that time and how much it was driven by toys and being kid friendly and how much pressure there was. It at the time I felt it was two different movies in one, and I still feel that, and I understand a little bit more why. And I think that's the big problem. It's trying to be one film and it's trying to be another film at the same time, and it never really comes together into feeling like a cohesive movie. But that's my thought, and I'm not really giving away my full thoughts on this thing because we'll chat about it as we go through.
So, you know, I did not watch the Schumacher commentary, but I've heard different reports on things that he said after this movie came out, and it sounded like he was kind of changing his tunes as he went along. So I don't even know how much you can rely on the accuracy of his commentary.
The only pieces that I really, I really brought it up just now, the amount of pressure, like the previous movie that he did with Val Kilmer, it was like they couldn't get sponsorship for that movie because people were Batman out, it's not a Burton film, those type of things. They had all those kinds of pressures. This one, they couldn't keep sponsors out of it. And the pressure for this to be kid friendly was a big thing that he kept talking about, but also how much things need to be inserted that could be toys. Mm-hmm. So we'll organically talk about that along the way. So I don't want to, you know, dive heavy into that, because I think as we talk about the film, we'll organically talk about the fact that that was clearly put there to be a toy. there were certain things that were clearly done to be for kids. I just thought I'm with you. I think he was kind of jumping around a little bit on it. And some of that is, I think, just a director trying to be tactful on what he was going through. But the commentary was interesting. I mean, I will say it made me able to go through it again. So we'll talk a little bit further about it. I don't want to derail the opportunity for the other guys to have a chance to share their.
And I'm going to suck up to our guests again for a moment and just say, if you're listening to a commentary and unless you're getting the actual filmmakers in there, listen to Zachy and Brian, because they do great commentaries on. They've been doing them more and more lately. I'm not sure if that's driven by anything in particular, but a lot of times I'm listening to you guys, and it's on movies that I haven't even seen, and I'm still entertained by it. Wow. So, you know, that's awesome. I appreciate what you guys do with that.
That means a lot. Thank you.
So, and now that I've sucked up enough, I'm going to say, Brian, when's the first time you saw this one?
Back in 97. I mean, I was, you know, I had seen, of course, the 60s TV show growing up, and then Tim Burton's Batman in 1989 changed my universe. And so I was in on anything that was Batman that was coming out ever since. And this is an interesting one because I kind of relate to what you said earlier, where my memory is, I mean, I love the Burton films. Batman Forever is like fine for me, but I've never quite loved it as much as other people have. And I know it's people aren't as enthusiastic about it, but there's a lot of love for it. But I remember going to see this one in the theater with my girlfriend at the time and being like, it's a Batman movie. Come on, let's go. Well, it'll be fun. And I remember apologizing to her when it was over. Like, that's what I remember. I really distinctly remember that, being like, I'm so sorry. I didn't know. And so I've had this funny journey with it where in my mind, oh, this one isn't very good. And then Zachy and I revisited it for a commentary a little bit ago. And I thought, maybe I'm being too hard on this. Like, this is the 60s version, born again. Like, maybe it's kind of fun as its own thing. It's just one of the Batman movies on the shelf, and maybe that's okay. But I got to say, when I was watching this two nights ago, it was really getting on my nerves. So, like, I guess, I don't know. It depends what mood I'm in. So
after your experience with your girlfriend, did you force your wife to watch this with you now?
No.
Risking losing a marriage over this stupid movie?
I would never.
And I'm going to throw in there, I started to watch this with my wife, and she was like, I just can't. And she walked away from it.
But isn't that kind of the funny thing? Because it is, whatever it's doing, and it is very 66-esque, right? I mean, you have the, right at the beginning, Commissioner Gordon is calling Batman. He's like, literally, I think I wrote it down. It's like, Batman, a new villain has frozen security guards at the museum into blocks of ice. He calls himself Mr. Freeze.
Sounds like the beginning of a commercial for a Mr. Freeze toy.
It does. It does. So there's part of me that thinks that should be fun, just having that version out there, right? And like I said, I've engaged with it and had fun before, but for some reason, I don't know, I just wasn't on its wavelength the other night. So
one of the things in the commentary that he talked about that I really liked was the fact that he was referencing Batman, the animated series, and what they did with Mr. Freeze there, and how there were some, and you can see them, there were certain key sequences like the little miniature and stuff like that, that he clearly pulled from there. So there's so many pieces in this where there was like, you were heading down the right path. Yes. Why didn't you? And then like somebody said abort. But it was, you're right. There was nuggets when it was like, oh my gosh, they're like throwing this out there, and it actually sounds like something interesting and intriguing. That's why I think this is going to be a great conversation, because I think there are interesting tidbits to talk about during this.
Totally.
That are in isolation, that if they were melded together into a film that had a consistent tone, I think could have been super cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, I definitely have some thoughts on what you were just going with, but I don't want to keep holding Zachy back on telling us what his first experience with this was.
I remember seeing they showed the trailer on Entertainment Tonight, and it was, you see the skylight crashes open and Batman lands, and he says, "Hi, Freeze, I'm Batman." I remember seeing that on Entertainment Tonight, and I said, Oh no.
So, of the four of us, you're the one who went in kind of trepidatious a little bit.
I was trepidatious when they swapped in Batman yet again, even though I was at the time, I only really knew George Clooney as Doug Ross from ER, and I loved him as Doug Ross on ER, but I just couldn't see him as Batman. So I was already skeptical about that switch. Like, I remember when they swapped in Kilmer for Keaton, and I was like team Keaton all the way. I still am. But I came to a peace with Val Kilmer. And then it's like swapping him. I already didn't like that. I remember initially they said Patrick Stewart was who they were looking at for Mr. Freeze. I'm like, right on. And then they're like, just kidding, Arnold Schwarzenegger. And I'm like, buh? You know? And so there was a lot of this stuff, and so I didn't see it during its initial theatrical run. I was busy because I graduated that summer from high school, but I caught it at a second run theater. And I've said this before, maybe I've said this to Brian, I went alone. I had an afternoon to kill, and I went to see it, and I regretted not having somebody to make comments to. So it was so loud and everything, and I would like literally turn to people behind me like, "Did you see that? Stupid," you know, because I just needed somebody to talk to, you know. I don't think it's a good movie. I remember I was so pissed off when the movie came out because I was like, "They killed the franchise, right?" Mm-hmm. And this is
and they kind of did.
It absolutely did. But here's the interesting thing, right? At that moment, I was like, "They killed the, you know, what started in '89," and what you realize with the benefit of, you know, almost 30 years of hindsight is, well, that franchise really died with the end of the Burton era, and it became something else. Mm-hmm. And you realize, like, well, if not for Batman and Robin killing the franchise, we don't get the Dark Knight trilogy. And in my opinion, what a shame that would be. And, you know, so there is perspective, like Brian said, you know, well, it's another, you know, title on the shelf. Some of them you like better than others. And so I'm at peace with that when it comes to Batman and Robin. I think it's objectively the worst of these four, probably the worst of any of the modern movies. But as Sean said, you know, there are things in it. There are specific aspects that I really like. And I've said this before. I think the stuff with Bruce and Alfred is probably the best in any Batman movie you've ever seen in terms of really getting to, you know, the real depth of their relationship. There's a terrific piece for me where Bruce says to Dick at the end, he's like, you know, I'm asking you as a friend, as a brother, as a partner, will you trust me? I love that, man. I'm like, we've never gotten that relationship. I'm still waiting for Batman and Robin again in movies. I feel like this movie, you know, peed in the pool so much, like, I don't know if we'll ever see it again, unfortunately. So to Sean's point, like, there's aspects of things that I really appreciate while acknowledging the movie is just a train wreck of a thing. But, you know, if anything, it demonstrates the elasticity of the myth that you can have, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger and George Clooney in a nipple suit, and you've got Robert Pattinson, and you know, and it's all Batman. I think that's just kind of cool.
You're forgetting
that's one of the
enormous
things.
Amounts of bat butt.
There is that too.
A lot of bat butt. Yeah,
too much bat butt.
Bat butt.
And but yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. There's sequences in this that I enjoy. I actually enjoy the opening sequence because I think there's a little bit of spectacle there with what they do, even though I think some of the special effects, like, you look at them and you think, were they really thinking that was going to get, you know, that they were going to get away with that? But if you turn your mind off to that, I think the opening sequence is pretty cool.
I just want to say I agree with that. When it started again the other night, I was like, this is fun. Like, this is the live action, more modern 60s take. Like, I'm like down for a version like this. I think that opening is a lot of fun.
Yeah, and I no question in my mind that had it kept up that level of fun, it would have been okay. But it really kind of drops down. Now, I guess I'm gonna just go ahead, Sean.
No, just building off of what you were saying there. I think the interesting part though is when you hear Schumacher on the commentary, he wasn't going for the 60s at all.
Mm.
And I think that's part of the problem. I think we all see that there was an opportunity to do a really good 60s style movie here. There was an opportunity to do something, to Zachy's point, do something a little bit more moving and a little bit more serious in what they were doing there. And that's where I feel like we've got two disjointed pathways that, like, if we just picked one of them and stuck with them, I think we could have had a good movie here. It's where I think we're all in agreement that this film is really chunks stuff going on instead of it doesn't ever really feel like a satisfying full film because of it. But there's like, I don't hate this movie. There's elements of it, elements that I love. There's parts of it that I'm like, why did you do this? and that's where it's really an interesting film to talk about. I'm sorry, Paul. I know you were going on.
No, that's fine.
That 60s piece, I just felt like I wanted to talk about that because I think that's important.
I want to build on that a little bit because my thought process is starting with the casting. At the time that this came out, I think we already had the Batman the Animated Series by this time. Yeah. And we had seen Michael and Sarah giving voice to Mr. Freeze and giving a depth to that character that we hadn't previously seen. And I think had they cast Patrick Stewart in the role, they probably could have gotten some of that. And I think the script would have been a little different. And I think we could have seen some of that with him and his wife and all that went on. But instead, I think they went for 1966 and they said, you know what? We had Otto Preminger playing Mr. Freeze and he had a German accent. Let's get Arnold Schwarzenegger to do it because it's going to be just like that. And I actually love Arnold Schwarzenegger. I understand he has limitations as an actor, but I think most of the times he's been in, or at least a lot of the films that I really enjoy, I think the directors and the script kind of understood his limitations and played with them correctly so that, you know, you go to True Lies or the Terminator movies or Total Recall. I love the, or Predator. I love those movies. And I think he's terrific in them because he's not asked to do too much. He's allowed to give his quips and kind of show off his muscular body. And, you know, everything's cool. In this one, first of all, he was way over the top with the quips. like every line that came out of his mouth was a quip. And I just think they didn't give him a chance, instead of really showing his relationship with Nora, we're going to just show some old films and we're going to have Arnold just smiling into the camera as if it's his wedding video and whatever. And it was awful. I honestly believe that the casting of Schwarzenegger and the way they used him was terrible. And it's one of the poor things in this movie.
And he had his whole gang singing to the Rankin Bass, which I was like, sitting there like, why did they put this in here? Because like, if you take this potentially threatening villain, because they did a good job of in certain sequences, like I thought some of the ice effects and things that they were doing with them, I thought were kind of cool. You make this potentially threatening villain, and then I get that they were trying to soften this up for kids. But that whole sing-along bit, I'm like, oh, no, what were you thinking throwing that in there? Sing, sing! I mean, it's like, why? Scream, scream is more what I was thinking.
Clooney has come under a lot of criticism, and some of it aimed at him by himself. Like he said, this is a terrible acting job. I honestly didn't think he was that bad as much as I thought the script let him down.
Ditto.
What we got in this was we got the warm and fuzzy Bruce Wayne who wants to treat it as family and all of this stuff. But we didn't have a character arc to bring him from the brooding Michael Keaton, Val Kilmer to the family loving George Clooney version. And if we had a character arc, if this movie had started with him brooding and somehow realizing the value of family and then became the warm and fuzzy Bruce Wayne, I would have enjoyed that. But I think the script let him down more than his acting did. There was just one scene in there where somebody's talking and all of a sudden he just starts like shaking his head. And I was thinking, well, that's not really a good acting moment. But other than that, I didn't think his acting was all that bad.
But I'm curious which moment you're talking about, because there's a moment every time I watch this movie that I look forward to when Alicia Silverstone has arrived and they're walking through the garden and Bruce Wayne calls out, oh, well, you're from such and such university. And she's like, how'd you know that? He's like, the patch on your jacket. And then he does this cocky little.
that might have been the moment. I'm
like,
not sure.
No one acknowledges him. So he's like waiting for people to like, nice, Bruce. And he like looks at all of them and does this little nod, but no one looks at them, and it cracks me up every single time.
So that's what he thinks is his Sherlock Holmes moment, that he was able to read a patch on his jacket.
We all saw it, Bruce. No, but I agree. That's a great point. If he had had a better arc. And to that point, I mean, I was wondering why Elle McPherson is in this movie.
Right. You would think she would have a purpose to bring that character arc about.
Yes.
But she doesn't.
No, well, apparently she just disappears.
Her character was supposed to die partway through, and
that would have been okay.
Yeah, that would have factored in some way to his journey. Yeah, because if you know, she just disappears halfway through the movie.
Yeah.
I wonder if they like just changed the script halfway through and just said, yeah, leave her out, or if they they doctored something up with her.
Yeah,
or
I'm not sure at what point in the process they decided not to, but yeah, that was certainly why she was supposed to be a more substantial character.
There's not really much death in the film. when you think about it. I mean, Poison Ivy, yes, there's certain elements to show that, you know, her kiss, you know, can kill. But it isn't one of those films that's really designed to have a lot of death. And actually, Schumacher even referenced the fact that his villains, like, his goal wasn't to kill the villains. He was, like, leaving the toys around for what he was hoping was a future for the franchise. He wasn't looking to do multiple sequels, though. He wasn't even looking to do a sequel, and came back to do this one. At least he says he wasn't. I don't know what that really
was. He's also said that he had plans for the fifth movie in the franchise that got scuttled. So, again, that's why I say, you know, there are different things that have come out of him.
Right.
And we're never going to know the reality. You know, he's not even around to say, well, I said this, but I meant that, or anything like that.
I think money also decides on that, too. You know, it could be, you know, you're thinking originally you're not going to do 3, 4, and 5, but then all of a sudden, you know, it's business, and sometimes that can be a nice payday piece.
Well, I saw where he said his plans for the fifth one were to do an adaptation of Frank Miller's The Dark Knight, and how you go from this to that, I have no clue. So I'm not, I'm not sure I'm buying it when he said those things.
I've heard those things too, and I'm like, I don't see how that would naturally come, even after Batman Forever, the sort of darker version he keeps saying he wanted to do.
You could have gone from Batman Returns to The Dark Knight.
Yeah.
He said he wanted, in the commentary, he wanted to do Year One as well.
Yeah, I saw that, yeah.
Which was an interesting sort of piece. And it's, I'm with you, I don't know how, and I think he was, though, looking at doing a younger Batman with Year One. So he referenced that piece where...
we're going to get another actor playing Batman now.
But I mean, doing a prequel instead of doing, you know, a sequel. And I see how that might give you a little bit more freedom. But he was looking more of going the dark route, because he said his films traditionally are dark. Now, again, take it with a grain of salt as far as what they're saying.
No, but I think that's borne out where, when you look at the breadth of his filmography, I mean, it's the Batman movies that are the exception. It's kind of this weird, you know, cosmic irony that his entire filmography has been pulled into the Batman singularity. But
yes,
one imagines that he got the gig. So Burton gets asked nicely to vacate, and they look, you know, you can imagine the Warner execs, like, oh, the guy who made the Lost Boys and, totally, you know, Flatliners. Oh yeah. You know, it's, and they were looking for, you know, Burton Light, LITE, and they kind of got that ish with Batman Forever. And so one imagines that his thought was probably, oh, I want to do something a little closer to my muse, have Batman Forever having done so well. But then, you know, as we said, the toy people get involved and they're like, oh, well, you got to have, you know, like 8 different bat suits, and oh, we got to have Batgirl and whatever else, you know.
Yeah, I don't necessarily disagree with that, but I think that, you know, if you want to try and put some truth on what he said, then I think what the way you would kind of interpret it is to say, if when they first hired him to do this, he wanted to do a darker movie and they made him do this, as opposed to, I did this and now I want to make my darker movie. It, that doesn't make as much sense to me.
Even the, it was funny when you were talking about the toys and all that coming into it, even the credit card was a sponsorship when he pulled
out. Oh yeah.
And he was referencing that during the commentary. He said this is an example of the difference between this movie and the previous one. He said the credit card was a sponsorship. He said there were so many things that we needed to put into the film. And he said, I'm going to be 100% honest with you. He said, we tried so hard to get that to get some form of that for the previous film. He said, this one, he said, I said yes to everybody, which I get that too, where it's kind of, it's a different sort of piece. And he was more saying it like it was a mistake. Actually, some of the parts where he was like taking ownership for mistakes along the way, he was actually, with some of the set design and things like that, he said, when you watch this film, he said, if it's not your cup of tea, and he said, believe me, I'm going to be honest, I know that it's not everybody's thing, but he said, there's certain things I want to point out, like take a look at some of these sets. He said, the set where they're holding up the observatory and stuff like that, he said, it's gorgeous. And he said, there's certain things in this film that he said, you know, really admire those people. He said, the stuff where he said, you got to throw stones. I'm the director. I should be taking those pot shots. But he was naming specific people along the way who were in charge of the set design and stuff like that and shouting him out. I thought that part was kind of cool where, you know, he was acknowledging the fact like, you know, hey, don't throw everything under the bus. There's some cool things that were going on here.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a good thing for a commentary on this movie to do, because this movie has come under such fire, and yes. I'm certainly throwing gasoline on that as we're talking, but to point out these are the positives, and it's not, let me pull myself out from under the bus. It's saying these are the guys who did this. You know, if he's just, yes. he's not the set designer. So if he's giving credit to the set designer, you know, it's not for his own purposes. It's because he probably truly believes they did a great job. And I think some of that is borne out, because I do think there's some set design stuff in this that's pretty cool looking.
Yeah, agreed.
But I guess.
Well, I was going to say something I wrote down. I just wrote down my thoughts as they were coming to me. And one of them was the toy makers are clearly in control, which we can get back to that again later too, which is kind of a fun conversation. But I also wrote, it's a paradox how this movie looks incredibly expensive and incredibly cheap at the same time. Because I agree. The observatory thing with the two hands holding it up, incredible, really inspired. And then you also, as much as I do enjoy the opening museum sequence, it really does look like an Icecapades version of Batman. I mean, obviously because there is ice involved, but it just looks so crazy and cartoonish, and just, you like, not even like the floor is made of ice, but they found some sort of like laminate sort of thing that resembles ice enough, you know, for the kids who, you know, are in the cheap seats at the ice show, you know, like it's weird. It's like a whole mix. It's a combination of those two things, right?
In the opening sequence where they were inside that container, you know, that piece was going off. He said there was a lot of pressure to do bigger and better than what we did. So he said, you'll see things that you can like harken back to Batman Forever. But he said that, you know, the goal with those things was then to, now we're going to do it bigger than we did then, because he said that was really popular at the time to out, you know, when you're doing a franchise, to outdo what you did in the previous one. And he said sometimes it's at the detriment of the story that you're telling there. And which I thought that was stuff was kind of interesting as far as the pressures behind that and what that looks like, especially when that doing franchises like that may not be your wheelhouse normally. I thought that was, it was fun analysis of a film that I think we all pick apart. It was kind of like fun sitting there with him going, a lot of it was, it seemed like an apology tour without it being that. But some of that's, so there were some interesting insights along the way that I thought were intriguing. And I thought that was one of them, you know, as far as the pressure to do bigger and better.
Yeah. And I kind of admire it. I mean, the beginning, all of it, but focusing on the beginning, like it does feel very big and bombastic and fun and spectacle, you know, but then it also, with that in mind, what you're saying, it makes me think they're like, well, what else? What else? Like, what if they're suddenly in a rocket and then they're like surfing on the doors of the rocket and Robin says, cowabunga, I don't know. What do you want from me? Like, that's kind of what it also feels like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, it definitely has some of that to it. But I thought just about all of the Mr. Freeze moments through the movie, as much as I think Arnold was miscast, but I think there is a certain slickness to the way the sets are and the scenes are and even some of the special effects, which again, sometimes mostly the ones I thought were mostly bad as far as those special effects were people falling, including Mr. Freeze falling into the formula. It's just like, but you know, it was, I thought, poorly done. But the sets all looked pretty good to me and, you know, almost had like a futuristic feel, which was kind of cool. But whenever they went to Poison Ivy and they tried to have like this jungle feel, and you'd have Bane, which we're going to get into him in a little while. And it would just be like, you know, it hurts my eyes to look at this. I'm not enjoying this.
What about it specifically?
Thought the color schemes were bad. And I thought that, you know, just some of the camera angles and the lighting, I didn't think it stood out as being what they're trying to present. You know, I felt that they were trying to present, I mean, I guess they were trying to present like a greenhouse feel for everything that she was around, but it just felt dirty. I don't know. There's something about it. It didn't sit well with me.
Yeah.
Her I liked though.
I did not. So let's talk about that.
Okay. Good. That's good, because I actually thought she was good casting.
I think Poison Ivy should be someone that you look at and think, oh, she's so pretty. I really think that you should be thinking that. I think Uma Thurman has a look of a fashion model, but I don't think she's a classic beauty by any stretch of the imagination. And I thought, especially with those, like the weeds growing out of her eyebrows, I thought she really looked like, to me, I would be like, ew, get away from me. So, you know, there was talk, I think, that he was considering Julia Roberts for the part. I think she would have been much more of the Poison Ivy that I picture in my mind.
It's so funny. I've never really minded her, to be honest. I can see what you're saying, but it is kind of fun, the mode that she's going for, like some sort of 1930s actress vibe, whatever, you know, the
come. She should be alluring.
Yeah, like, but it, again, I apparently this isn't what Schumacher had in mind, but I just, it feels so of a piece of like the 66, you know, vibe, where it's just having these actors come in and get to be hammy. And I thought, I don't know, she went for it and it was fun. And her costumes are outrageous. And within this movie, she works okay for me, I think.
To bring it to the 66 feel, I thought her acting was almost inspired, like kind of a recreation of Julie Newmar as Catwoman.
Sure. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I think that I agree with you on that.
Yeah.
One of the things I liked about her was the duality of Pamela Isley versus Poison Ivy, where she was very bookwormish, very, you know, I guess unappealing at that point in time. She was very normal, just very basic, very normal, because she was so enthralled in her studies. And then when she became Poison Ivy, it was such a dramatic transformation, a very different kind of person. But when she would hide, it was almost like she'd put back on Pamela Isley in order to.
But isn't that similar to the transition that we already saw by Michelle Pfeiffer in Batman Returns?
Oh, I'm sure that they were.
Isn't it like, you know, the way all the villains are doing their Jack Nicholson imitation? Maybe all the women are doing their Michelle Pfeiffer imitation. I don't know.
I wouldn't disagree. I think if you're any actress who is at this point in time looking to jump into this film series, I think you look at what Michelle Pfeiffer did, and we're kind of hoping lightning would strike twice. So I would agree with you on that piece. The interesting part is costumes, where if you didn't like them, she had a big role in designing her costumes. Something that Schumacher put in that piece. He gave her
the Red Skull in Captain America First Avenger. She is failing.
Yeah. Yeah, I liked it. I thought she was good. So we disagree on that one, but.
And it's fine. I appreciate a good disagreement where I don't get a bloody nose when it's over. So.
Well, I'm not that passionate about it. I just said I liked her. I wasn't like sitting there like, oh my gosh, it was a deal breaker for me.
So just to, I'm going to bring it to the worst one before I go anywhere else, and just, you know, Bane. What the hell were they thinking? Anybody, any thoughts? Anybody going to defend the look and or presentation of that character?
Well, I'm not going to defend it, but I'm sure the thinking at the time, Bane was like a virtually brand new character at that time. So they figured, we need a muscle, and there's this guy here, and they probably didn't, you know, I'm going to assume Akiva Goldsman hadn't read any of the recent comic books, and they're like, there's this big muscle bound guy wearing a luchador mask. Let's just throw him in there. We'll call him Bane. The rubes will love it. You know, rubes meaning the comic fans, you know, and it has no connection whatsoever to that's the ironic thing. Like, in terms of the look, they got the look of the character, but they made, you know, it's like a cosplay version. You know what I mean? It's like something.
Yes. Like, I could see him walking around at Comic-Con.
Right. Exactly. You know, whereas like when you look at the Tom Hardy version of Bane, well, he doesn't really look like Bane from the comics, but the personality, they absolutely nailed that, you know? So it's this weird, I think now we look at Bane in a different way. Like, there's an expectation because he has been sort of grandfathered in as one of the main bat nemeses. At that time, he was like brand new. And the movie people, you can tell how little they cared about fidelity to the comics. Like, oh, Barbara Wilson, she's Batgirl. It's like, well, no. Batgirl has an identity. Yeah, you know what I mean? Like, that's the stuff that sticks out, where I don't think you would see that today. Where, oh, yeah, oh, Alfred has a niece. Yeah, he's 180 years old, but he's got a teenage niece. Just roll with it.
he's going to call his 30-something year old brother to take care of her.
Yeah, exactly.
Honestly, well, you know, you saw it today, Zach. At your point, a larger audience would be up in arms, and it may actually tank the film,
right?
Before it's even come out. Most of the things there's a lot less tolerance for that now.
I agree with that. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, it's interesting because I was already like up in arms about the new Fantastic Four movie before it came out, because they're going to make the Silver Surfer a girl. And I was like, what the hell? And then somebody said, no, it's a different reality, and it's Shia LaBeouf. I said, okay, I'll wait and see it now. But I was ready to join the internet lynch mob on that.
It is amazing how far we've come, isn't it? I was explaining to someone yesterday that George Clooney was in The Flash. And they're like, who did he play? I was like, well, okay. So look, there's this whole like multiverse sort of thing going on, and they expected Ben Affleck to come out, but then it was actually the Batman from the 1997 Batman and Robin reality that The Flash saw. And I was like, wow, remember when they didn't trust audiences to follow comic book logic? And now they just expect us all, like, we are all steeped in it. We do.
Now you have Michael Keaton with a bowl of spaghetti and you're just rolling it.
Exactly. By the way, the Bane, my favorite Bane, I'll just say real quick, my favorite Bane moment in this movie, I think, is the surveillance photo of them deboarding a private jet. And like Poison Ivy's in the front and he's like in a trench coat and he looks like Raphael. And he's holding all this luggage. I mean, that's what we're doing. That's what we're doing here.
Mm-hmm. Well, and again, I think that goes to what Sean said earlier, that they didn't know what to embrace with this movie. Mm-hmm. Because that's a Batman 66 moment.
Oh, yes.
That's totally. You know, that's the Joker as Commodore Schmidlap, and nobody realizes who he is, you know? but you know, to do that and try and have any element of seriousness to the movie is just, you know, you're crossing streams. It doesn't work. So that's one of the it's amusing in and of itself. And that kind of goes to what I had said my viewing was of this between 1997 and 2025, so over 28 years. I've never seen this movie after the first time I saw it from beginning to end until I watched it now. But I've seen clips from it, you know, here and there. It's on TV and I see a couple, 10 minutes of it and then I move on to something else. And in 10-minute clips, this is kind of enjoyable. But when you try to watch it on a whole, I feel like it just loses any cohesiveness at all. So, you know, that's kind of ultimately where I fall on this thing. I'm going to hold back on my opinion on it and say, what's everybody's opinion of Alicia Silverstone as Batgirl?
Yeah, it's funny. I actually, with what you were just saying, again, when you see the clips, that is why I think sometimes that I think this movie is fun, because there are moments of fun in this movie and camp and whatever. But watching it this time and the way that Batgirl is inducted into the group at the end, where it's basically like she just shows up, I'm this long lost niece, she finds the Batcave, it's like, oh, guess what, you know, I made you a costume, it's cool, go join everybody, even though you've shown no previous interest in justice or, you know, or anything like that. And then she just shows up like, I'm part of the team now. They're like, cool, welcome. You know, like, that's how seriously the movie takes it all. So then, when you watch it as a whole, that's why it's not as much fun as when you just see the fun pieces on their own, right? Because the movie itself just doesn't seem to care, you know?
My problem with her is the same as my problem with Bane. Bane should have been an original character, done something different with him. It probably would have, you know, Thug Number 3 would have worked so much better than just trying to make that into Bane, because I find Bane offensive because of the fact that they just didn't bother doing any homework on the character they were throwing in the film. I think the same problem with Batgirl. I actually like what they were trying to create this family with. Yes. There were some family elements in this that I really quite enjoyed. So I understood what they were trying to do. I don't think she was, I think we could give her the same thing that we give George Clooney, as far as saying that I think she did a fine job with the script she was given. I don't like hate her portrayal of what she was doing in the film. I just don't know why that had to be Batgirl. I don't think there was enough time for what they were doing in the film to embrace her being Barbara Gordon, because they wanted to link her to Alfred so much. So I don't know why they didn't just create a unique character for the purpose of this film series. And that would have been, I think that goes back to the toys thing, right? You're now creating Batgirl toys. And I think that put a lot of limitations on it. Now you're creating a Bane toy. You're creating a Batgirl toy. I think there were certain characters that they're like, let's use characters from the Batman mythos because of the fact that they can be toys off of this. So I didn't hate her. I was underwhelmed because of the fact that I would have much rather seen a Batgirl that I was really excited about. I think she runs into the same problem that they do. They did those weird costume bits where everyone's suiting up and we're seeing bat butt and all kinds of crazy stuff going on there. And I'm like, why? Why did you do this? Cause I actually agreed with the concept about Clooney before. I didn't think Clooney was that bad. I think the costume is really problematic. Like when I see him in the costume takes me out of the whole thing. And I think she ran into the same problem. I think that costume kind of took me out of it because they did the thing where her bat ears was like her bicycle helmet. And then she had to take it off when she was there. And I'm like, what are we doing with this? I'm not surprised. This has actually been an interesting discussion because I think we're all kind of in the same place, but like in different ways. And those are always the most fun for me because I think we all key on different elements of this film.
I remember I started college the fall, like the within months of this movie coming out. And in my English 101 class, we had to write a persuasive essay. And my essay was like, why Joel Schumacher ruined Batman? You know, like that's how passionate I was back then, you know. And I look at that now and I'm like, must have been nice when that was the most important thing on your mind. Like, like who cares, you know? Mm-hmm. And again, it's like I said, you know, if Batman and Robin doesn't crash and burn, we don't get Batman Begins. And that would have been a shame for me because that's one of my very favorites out of all of them, you know?
Right.
Well, how about, you know, I'm just thinking, you know, you had that and Adam Murdo had his doctorate thesis on Crisis on Infinite Earth. So, you know, there's definitely a level of passion that we all share. but some of us, you two guys, take it so far. But, you know, ultimately with your work as a teacher and as a movie critic, I think that, you know, that probably had more nexus to what your career is than most people's college work. So,
that's true.
You know, there's something to be said for that.
Very true.
You'll see as your kids start going to college, you're going to be amazed at how little they do that is going to be, you know, this is useful for after you get out of college. You know, there's right. So little of it. It's kind of scary at times.
Yeah.
So just back to Alicia Silverstone. I thought, much like what Sean was saying, that I didn't think she did a bad job. I thought the script let her down at times. I thought there was kind of an arc there, but they didn't really develop it. They just went from, here's the beginning of the arc where she thinks, oh, look, my uncle is just your servant and, you know, you mistreat him, to, yes, we're all part of the same family. And they didn't really show how she made that journey. So that's the problem I had, and that goes more to the script. Then I also take an external view on this, is from what I understand, she was really just not treated nicely about this movie. She was body shamed and criticized, and I just feel like it just was unfair. So I'm more likely to give her, you know, some more slack just based on that alone.
The one thing I did like that they did is they set up pretty quickly with her this idea that her hidden secret was that she was this adventurer. You know, like she liked to sneak out at night, ride a motorcycle. She liked the thrill, you know, she was a, you know, thrill junkie, that type of thing. And when Alfred, she was passionate for Alfred. She loved Alfred. I mean, that was really, really clear. And I actually liked that whole concept. I didn't need it to be Batgirl, but I liked that whole concept with her. And there was a reason when he gave her that disc. Like, we all knew at that point in time with what we knew about her that she was opening that doggone thing. And there would be something when you start seeing the secret. She did have this thirst for being right. And I get why when she opened that up, there would be a reason that she would want to show them, I figured it out. You know, and that part, I was kind of like, okay, I get the logic behind all of it. It's why so much of it, I think the script failed her, because it would have worked so much better for an original character. And I think they were stuck with, you have to make Batgirl because
of but what could that... you have done Batgirl and made her Barbara Gordon and just, you know, doctored the script. You know, I the whole thing is, I guess they wanted her to be Alfred's niece so that you could have him coincidentally have the same illness that Freeze's wife has. Yeah. You know, but other than that, I don't really see a purpose in her not being Barbara Gordon.
Here's the reason why I'm giving that a pass, but I agree with you. I think why she can't be Barbara Gordon, or why you need that character, is one of the best things of the film to me is Alfred's arc.
Alfred's where I was going to go next.
Yeah,
Michael Goh is the best actor in this movie.
Yeah,
in my mind, there's no question.
So why I'm linking that with her, I think that's what makes her character's insertion problematic. Because you can't really do a Barbara Gordon arc, because it's now like you're shoveling in this other arc that just doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I agree with you. I would rather her be Barbara Gordon for all the reasons that you're thinking of. But I think the central arc of the film was, forget the weird connecting thread to what was going on with Freeze, you know, with the particular disease. But the best part of the film to me was the Alfred arc. I thought the Alfred arc moved me. I thought it was some great acting. There are some scenes in this film that are like, they'll choke you up emotionally in a film that I think is not a good film. But those sequences, I think some of them border on brilliance in what they were doing, and which is so weird to say in this film. It's got bubbles. But some of those bubbles are special ones.
I think the ultimate problem with this movie is the whole toy connection, though. Mm-hmm. Because what they had was, you know, we want to have this, we want to have that, we want to have, you know, all these different things to sell to the consumers, and we're going to throw them all together. Now give us a script that includes them all.
Yes. Mm.
And I think that's the problem. And I can't even blame the script writers that much, because they're probably shaking their heads and saying, how the hell am I going to work this in?
Right.
You know, but I think there's a lot of fat in this script that could have been excised, and you could have replaced it with things that would create story arcs for these people, or character arcs, rather.
I wonder how much of it was the other way around, like where they had like a halfway decent script and now you have to plug in all this other stuff. And it starts, you know, you have to start excising good things in order to plug that.
Yeah. So the arcs just become like bullet points.
Yeah,
so it's
yeah.
like, I mean, we're picking up on them because the bullet point is present, but they didn't allow the real estate because they had to fit in another motorcycle or, you know, some sort of toy or something that they need to show off. I'm longing for this version you guys are talking about, which I got to be honest, I haven't really thought that deeply about. But like the whole family thing with Bruce Wayne realizing, you know, that he's pushing people away, and at the end, he really does have a family, and you could bring Elle McPherson back for that, where she's like, look, I want to be a part of your life. And he's realizing or thinking he doesn't have room for people in his life. And at the end, it's like, well, these people are his life. You know, that's kind of a lovely ending.
If you're going to focus on family, if you're going to make that the true focus of this movie, then doesn't it make sense that Alfred is already part of Bruce's family? And you make the story about showing how he is Bruce's surrogate father. Bruce is a surrogate brother to Dick, because there's not enough of an age difference for him to be his surrogate father. And then you have Commissioner Gordon, who somehow you give him a better arc. And I like Pat Hingles, so I'm kind of cool with giving him a little bit of a story. And then you have his daughter, and you're really making the whole family aspect of it more prominent.
Well, you could be their family's friends. Where in the premise you're setting up, and Pat Hingle didn't really have the arc.
He had no arc.
But I'm going to correct something I said earlier, where you were talking about how it could have been Barbara Gordon. I'm like, if you gave Pat Hingle an arc in this one and actually showed them as the two families as friends, you would have had a reason for Barbara Gordon to have a connection with that family and maybe be so passionate about them that may have been workable. So you could have done Barbara Gordon in this. Now, that's
embrace the Batman 66 thing, Commissioner Gordon was friends with Batman and friends with Bruce Wayne, but just too stupid to realize they were the same person. You know, I mean, but otherwise, you know, you could still develop something there. And again, you're developing the family arc, which I feel like that would work for me. That would solve a lot of the problems of this movie, because a lot of the problems, again, it's not a lack of spectacle. There's plenty of that in this movie. So now you need to work in the real emotion. And instead of having a character arc where at the beginning they're this and at the end of they're this, but we're not going to have anything to show how it developed, now we're going to show how it developed and how it changed.
Yeah. And you this know, something actually, you brought up, oh, just real quick, that you brought up that I thought was really interesting about Bruce and Dick being more like brothers than a father-son relationship. That's been sort of my issue with both this and Batman Forever, where Chris O'Donnell is sort of in this weird in-between space where he's playing a young person, but his face betrays him and he looks kind of like a 30-year-old. So it's like, but he behaves like a 20-year-old,
like a teenager,
or a 19-year-old or something. Yeah. So it's like, you almost wish they would just choose like, all right, well, just have him behave like an older person and have it be more of a brother relationship versus this petulant, you know, kid sort of vibe that he's giving off. You know, like for a minute, I was even thinking, like, what if it was like a Tom Holland type, you know, sort of thing where he feels like a boy. I was like, I would actually really like to see how Bruce would interact with someone like that. You know, well, someone
that,
who's
that same
pretty capable.
Character relationship, that same relationship was much better done much better by Robert Downey Jr. and Tom Holland.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the kind of relationship, you know, that was kind of a father-son relationship.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's you know, there's some fun moments between them, but it never feels quite right, you know, because of they don't settle on, he's written young, but he's played by someone much older, and it just always feels a little off.
And I just was going to throw in, you know, we mentioned Pat Engel, like his whole character arc is Poison Ivy makes him fall in love with her and then says, oh, you're an old man, and walks away from him. It's kind of really disrespecting him as a person so much. And, you know, Pat Engel has been around, well, you know, now he's gone, but he was around forever and played a lot of good roles. And I just feel like they gave him nothing in this movie.
I do have a superhero 101 moment for Chris O'Donnell's Robin, though. Perhaps. Just perhaps when you're not dressed up as Robin and you're going out on your motorcycle, maybe your helmet shouldn't have a Robin on it. Just a thing. I don't know. I think like Bruce Wayne probably shouldn't wear a helmet that says Batman on it. I'm just thinking that might be a thing, because I was laughing during that whole motorcycle sequence when he was chasing after her. His helmet's a Robin helmet. I'm like, well, how did she not know then that he was Robin? It's like, why did we need the disc for her to discover that's who they are? He literally had it on his face. So I didn't understand that choice, other than the fact, you know, for us as viewers, I mean, it's a cool looking helmet, don't get me wrong. I thought it was a way cool helmet, but it just doesn't work, because talk about camp. It's like, I'm Robin right here. It's red, bright. It's on my face. How did not everybody know that that's who it is?
Boy wonder, everybody. Here I am.
Well, this is, I mean, it does feel like a movie made for like 10-year-olds or something, right? Yeah. Like, you just, you know, have the helmet with the Robin thing on it. And then also, I just love the whoever created this, but when she opens up the disc that shows the secrets of Batman in the Batcave, and it's just this crazy, like, early 2000s internet looking GeoCities thing where it's just like designs just falling from top to bottom. Like, just, you know, it doesn't look like an actual document that anyone would ever use.
There's a ton of movies out there, and you know, I would go to most of the early Pixar movies, almost every one of them, that are designed for a full family to watch.
Yes.
Without ever dumbing it down so that the adults have to say, oh, you know, I'm sitting through this, but I have to because I have a 10-year-old at home. This movie really feels like it's aimed at a 10-year-old, and they're saying, you know what, if you're an adult and you want some logic, go see a different movie. Yeah, we're going to get you to pay for a ticket because you have to bring your 10-year-old, but we're not trying to entertain you at all. I would imagine, Zachy, you have some similar experiences. I remember taking my kids to the movies when they were little, and if we saw something that was, you know, again, like an early Pixar movie, I was enthralled through the whole thing. And afterwards, I'd sit there, you know, talking to a 5-year-old about, oh, wasn't this great? Wasn't that great? Whereas, like, I remember taking them to see the Yu-Gi-Oh movie. And halfway through the movie, I just put in headphones and I was listening to my iPod because I just couldn't deal with it anymore. So, you know, there's the different ends of the spectrum. But if you really put the effort into it, there's no reason you can't make a movie for the whole family where everybody is entertained. And I don't think they did that here.
I think they had a skeleton of a movie that was made for adults. And they took sequences and said, we have to adjust this to make it appropriate for kids. And what ends up happening with that is that never works. Because you haven't made a good movie for kids. You haven't made a good movie for adults. It's disjointed. It never, like, to your, I think your Pixar example, Paul, is brilliant. Because what's great about a Pixar movie is they tell a good story first. And inside there, there's so many things that you're right. They don't dumb down. There's jokes that are in there for adults that you know kids aren't going to get. But because there's such a foundationally good story there that kids can follow and really enjoy, those sequences that are clearly made for adults that are going to catch the nuances to them all work because of the fact that the adults are following the same good story. It's something that everybody can enjoy because the A to B just works for everybody. This has an A to, like, it's almost like a crime scene. You're trying to figure out how we got to at the end. Because tonally, it just jumps all over the place. And there's sequences that are clearly just, like, Paul, you're referencing the Poison Ivy sequence. Even when Schumacher was talking about the auction, it was like that was put in to put in like a dance number to make it like fun at that sequence. And it does feel like kind of this weird thing that was just kind of put into the movie. It's almost like jumping around a lot. This film jumps around a lot, which is
Again, I feel like that's what made it so that I could watch just a segment of it and start to think that it's better than what it is. Mm-hmm. You know, we talk sometimes about how, you know, the whole could be more than the sum of its parts. In this one, I think the whole is less than the sum of its parts, you know, and that's why, like, watching it from beginning to end was, to be fair, it was a disappointment. I expected to enjoy it more sitting down to watch it. I expected to be the one who was defending it while you guys blasted it. So, you know, that's happened a couple of times on our James Bond retrospective where I'm saying, no, I like this. And, you know, we just did Die Another Day. And I was actually surprised that everybody wasn't as down on it as the internet is. But on this one, you know, me and the internet, we're buddies on this one.
Did you ever hear about the fan cut of this movie?
No, I've heard of it about forever, but not this one.
They did a Batman and Robin deassified cut. I've never seen it. It was a fan produced cut. I don't know if it's available anywhere anymore. I just did a search right now for it, but I remember back maybe about 10 years ago, I heard about it and meant to seek it out and watch it just to see what they did. Cause obviously they cut out stuff and like made an edit. Oh. And I think there are things in this where, like, if you did trim out some things, you could totally make an interesting shorter film that
I know they've done that with Tolkien, with the Hobbit trilogy, where somebody has taken it and cut out a lot of the things to try and make it truer to the book. And I haven't seen anything where that got, you know, a lot of legal entanglement. Yeah. But I'm pretty sure Warner Brothers was very, very big on protecting its IPs. So I think, you know, if something was going around with another cut of their movie, they probably would be serving cease and desist
orders. Oh, I'm sure that's what happened with it.
What did you guys think of the score? I felt it was trying hard to be Danny Elfman and kind of...
I'm somewhere in the middle on it. I think there's some fun stuff happening, but it also feels very pummeling. You know, I mean, I think I mentioned this on Batman Forever, but I'll never forget seeing that in the theater. And the opening sequence with the whole safe and it's being filled with acid and the guard, like, it's boiling
acid.
Yeah. And I remember thinking, even as a kid, I mean, this is supposed to be directed at me. And I'm thinking, this is really loud. Like, you know, as like someone who enjoys like heavy metal and punk music, that's a strange thing for me to say. So like, maybe I think this one follows in that vein. And I was like, is there something wrong? Truly, I actually thought this. Is there something wrong with my sound the other night? Because it sounded like the voices were clipping a little bit. And I was like, no, I think this is just mixed like really harshly. You know, I think they just, what I call pummeling, I'm sure they thought was like, you know, like, oh, kids are going to love this. It's just so big and
boom, it's headbanging.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, no, you know, maybe it's just making up for something that's not there and trying too hard. And then it becomes headache inducing. So anyway, I mean, well, going back to that auction sequence, there's the score is trying to go for this kind of fun, crazy, circusy sounding thing. And I was like, I get this. I get what you're doing here. Like, this sounds kind of fun, but it's just so freaking loud. It fills every area of your senses. And then it becomes, it's not fun anymore. It's just too much. And I think this movie, a lot of it is very much, you know.
I liked the score, and I'm with everything you're saying. I'm just more nodding along. But there were elements of where I liked it. Like, I remember the score working really well. That sequence where they're going down the arm to the fingers. Mm,
yeah.
I thought that was just a really intense sequence. I thought the music worked really well for it. Like, there's sequences in here where I'm like, that worked. That was, like, fun. Batman almost killed Robin. I mean, it was great. He deactivates his bike, and I'm, like, sitting here like, really? We're counting on the fact that he's going to be all right? That was pretty close there, Batman. Right. I'm like, all right, like, I get you're trying to prove a point here, but where are we going with this?
I actually thought he might have a better chance getting across that thing than you will in that big, heavy car.
But the music through that sequence, through the whole thing, you know, straight on through to the end, I thought the music really served the action of that sequence well. I agree with you, though, there's many sequences where I did feel like it was pummeling me. I wasn't thinking of it in that term until you said it. And I'm like, I think it's similar to other parts of the movie. I think there's a disjointedness to it. But
yeah, I blame the mix, by the way. I actually think the score is pretty fun and good and interesting. I don't even blame the mixers. I think that was a choice. I mean, that was a decision to make. You know, in the early 2000s, a lot of music was being heavily compressed. So it'd just be wall-to-wall sound, and then it's just too crunchy and overwhelming, and it just doesn't sound. There's no highs and lows or anything to it anymore. It reminds me of that. It's like, let's just push everything forward, and it'll feel big, and everyone will love it. And so then it undermines, a good score and everything.
I remember the most pummeling movie to me was when we saw Man of Steel in the theater. The music in that was just head pounding. That I remember, like, during the movie, and she wasn't a little kid at the time. She was probably, I mean, what is that, 10 years ago? 12 years ago?
12 years ago, man. Yeah.
So my daughter would have been 12 years old at the time. So she wasn't a baby, whatever, but she was, you know, still a kid. And she just looked at me and said, could they lower this music? you would think a 12-year-old would be like, yeah, I don't care. But it was just, I remember that just being pummeling. And when you describe that for this, that's what it brought back to me. And I think it's a pretty descriptive word for it. And I think it's pretty accurate.
It's almost like you wish they would put more trust in your audience to not have to be, you know, just be louder and bigger and brighter. And then they can't look away and they'll love it. It's like, oh, like, just trust us a little bit. And like, subtlety's nice sometimes.
The big and the small,
it all in concert, you know, that's what makes up an entertaining movie.
Well, that's what we're talking about here, though. I mean, the reality is we're saying, and I think you guys are agreeing with me, I know I'm saying, that if they had still had the spectacle in it, but added the character moments, this would have been a much better movie. And they kind of glossed over the character moments. So, you know, I think ultimately that's where it fails.
Yeah.
Is there anything else to add on this one?
Toys. I think you want to talk about toys a little bit, Ryan, as far as that.
I will say, you know, I that's just, I mean, I write for kids television. So believe me, I understand the term toyetic. And, you know, I've literally been in meetings where someone is like, we need a submarine. They want a submarine toy. And I'm like, okay. Like, and so, and I've told Zachy this, like, I don't always hate it. Because sometimes you're like, all right, well, let's think of a story with a submarine. That's kind of cool. And like, how can I make that fun and interesting and fit within, you know, this universe? But this one, it just starts to get very like comical by the end of it, because it's like, I was looking at Batman's costume and I thought, wait, is that a different costume? Why does he have a different costume now? And also it's so over designed that it doesn't even look cool anymore. It reminds me of when you go to the store as a kid and you just want Batman to look like the black suit from Burton's Batman. Like, I want the normal cinematic looking suit that I saw in the movie. But of course, that's all sold out because everyone wants that. So you get the weird one where it's like, it's camouflage Batman, even though he's never done that in the movies before. Like, we have it here. And like, that's what those suits started to remind me of by the end of this. It's like those bad take, you know, colorized suits that you don't want as a toy. But it's like, you can imagine the toy company like, hey, it's really easy to paint these things kind of like a reddish color, so like, let's have them have a red costume in here, you know. And then of course, yeah, all of a sudden they're on these like funny vehicles that don't feel organic to anything we've seen before. And it's, you know, it's somebody, you just have to throw your hands up and be like, all right, I recognize what's happening here. It's just too bad they couldn't also, to what everyone said already multiple times, I could even live with that a little bit if they had spent the time to nurture the characters better and at least deliver a story that I can feel something for by the end of it.
And there's also the aspect of, yeah, they ask you to put a submarine into the story and you could work something around that. But we're going to put, we want you to put in a submarine, a helicopter, a motorcycle.
Yes, yes.
You know, three different types of lairs. You know, it becomes a little cumbersome with the script writing, I think.
Right.
Mr. Freeze's ice vehicle. If you,
yes,
if you take a look at every scene that's in, how slow it goes, that was literally how fast they could get it to go. Schumacher revealed that. He said this was an example of something that we put in the film. It looks cool. And I'll agree with that. It actually is a cool looking vehicle. But he said the worst part about working with that doggone vehicle is, he said, as fast as you see it go in those scenes is literally, he said, I wanted it to go faster. And there's scenes where it like is comical with the fact that like you feel that it would be better if you were the thugs to get out, run in front of it, get there faster. Like, there was no functional purpose for the film, for the vehicle, other than the fact that it happened to broadcast villain is coming,
right.
which was really interesting. But that was an example of another thing they put in there because of the toys. Design wise, I thought that looked all right. But I agree with you on the like some of the costume choices and things, like having Batman, Robin, and Batgirl have the same outfit when it's a bad outfit doesn't work. I get that they were going for the family aspect, but it's, how do you make a bad Batman outfit? Like, ow, it's Batman.
Well,
it's new variations and still make it look cool. They managed to find a way to do a variation that doesn't.
See, and that's, I'm curious what you guys think, because when I look at the Batmobile, again, all I see is an over-designed toy. It's like, yes. Well, it's got to be different. So like, let's, it's sort of like when Homer designs the car and he just overthinks it and keeps adding things and adding things and adding things. And then it becomes like this monstrosity, you know? It's like, I mean, you already nailed it in the first one. Frankly, I'd be fine seeing that Batmobile over and over again. But like, I understand the impulse. It's like, well, they already have that toy, so you got to have a, you got to buy a new toy, a new version mm-hmm. of the Batmobile. But then it's just, I don't always understand the thinking that goes into these designs because I just find them ugly. You know, yeah. I don't know.
Personally, I always loved the Batman 66 Batmobile.
Yeah.
So totally. To me, that's never been topped, no matter how serious or how practical they try to make it. It's never been a better one than that. And I just picture in my mind, you know, the flames coming out of the exhaust. And I love that car.
Yeah. So cool.
So, you know, it's there's certain classic things. I mean, I guess the first movie first Burton movie tried to get the more traditional, you know, Batman car of like the 1930s and 40s, which always makes me think of Courageous Cat and Minute Mouse's car, but that's, you know, that's okay.
But I have to Google that. I don't know that.
Oh, you know, well, see, that's because I'm old.
Another Bob Kane creation, Courageous Cat and Minute Mouse.
That I didn't know.
Yeah.
So I learned something new here.
Or maybe creation. I haven't dug
it. Maybe you're going to ask Bob Finger if he created it. But unless you got anything else, I think we can rate this. So I'm going to say that, as I said earlier, I think the whole is less than the sum of its parts. I think as a movie, this is not cohesive. It doesn't tell character arcs for the various characters. I think the acting is not nearly as bad as the reputation of the acting, with the exception of one of my favorites, Arnold Schwarzenegger, where his acting is awful in this movie. I just think that it just fails on multiple levels that we've pretty much gone through. And as much as I want to give it a Jaws 3, I'm going to give it a Jaws 4. I think this is honestly a bad movie. It's again, it's got its moments, but the moments aren't cohesive and it does not make it a good film. There's just a couple of moments that you say, oh, that's a good thing. You know, I guess the highlight of the whole movie is Michael Goh's performance again in my mind and some of the spectacle, but that's not enough to sew it all together. So I'm going to give a very rare Jaws 4.
I'm going to go with Jaws 4 too. Actually, it's a Jaws 4 movie with Jaws 2 scenes. There's some sequences with Alfred and Bruce that I just think are brilliant, and they are Jaws 2 scenes. So when I'm giving it that rating, I want to acknowledge the fact that I do rewatch this movie. And usually for me, that's enough for me to tip it up a level, you know, kind of go, it shouldn't be a Jaws 4. It should be a Jaws 3 because I do rewatch this. But I'll admit, I rewatch this because I'm a Batman junkie. So if I'm watching the other three, I do end up going to this and rewatching it. I do like those Alfred sequences quite a bit. I do think they're Jaws 2 sequences, but it's not enough to make the film go up for me. I think it's disjointed. And it really is Jaws 4 because it's tonally, we kind of dissected it literally. And it's kind of easy to do because it's already kind of done for us. But that's kind of my thoughts on it. But I will admit, I'm not going to say that I hate this film. I don't rewatch this film, but it's a Jaws 4 movie that I rewatch.
We're like, who's gonna say it first?
We got a Mexican standoff.
Go ahead.
No, I would put it, I would give it a Jaws 3, honestly.
Me and, too. And oh, yeah.
I think for me personally, I think Jaws 4 is sort of, to me, it doesn't work on any level. And Batman and Robin, there are a few levels that I'm able to acknowledge, well, they did that well. And so that's why I give it a Jaws 3.
Same. And I was going to say, Sean, you kind of summed it up for me where it's maybe Jaws 4 with Jaws 2 scenes peppered through. And I was like, yeah. So, I mean, really, when you guys were both going 4, I was like, I don't know. I'm kind of feeling 3. And when you said that, I was like, no, I think I'm going to use that because that's kind of it. Like, it fails on so many levels. And that's kind of frustrating. But I also have to admit that sometimes I was watching it with a critical eye preparing for this, and I can't help but tear it down. But I have caught it in chunks before, and I've even watched it with Zachy before where I'm like, is this good? Not really. But like, is it doing what it's doing to a fun degree, you know, more often than not? Yeah. Yeah. Like, I can't take it very seriously as a film, but like as a pop art or whatever you want to call it, that's just 2 hours long, another Batman thing on the shelf, and this is the one that is uniquely itself. I can't help but be entertained by enough of it to at least give it a 3, I think.
Cool. See, this almost takes us full circle to what I was describing at the beginning of Zachy's description of the Tim Burton Planet of the Apes. If you squint just right and you kind of say, it's okay. I actually went into this anticipating giving it the very, very rare Jaws 19, which is so bad that it's funny.
I like that.
That's what I expected to do. And the problem is, as I watched it, I didn't laugh at all. So I can't give it the it's funny.
Yeah.
But, you know, this is where we came down. So I was looking forward to having you guys on soon to talk about Batman Begins, but pursuant to our earlier conversation, we're going to interrupt that to go to Mask of the Phantasm. And I think we're just going to do the Return of the Joker, but I don't think we're going to do any of the other animated ones. There's too many animated ones that are not particularly important. I think those are really the only two that have a significant weight to them that we could have a lengthy conversation about. So I think that's where we'll go. If anybody thinks of anything I'm skipping that's worthwhile, let me know. But otherwise, I think that's where we'll go next time out, as soon as we see how everybody's schedule looks.
In the
meanwhile, thank you, Zachy Hassan and Brian Hall, for coming on and joining Sean and I on this discussion, which is always enjoyable. Just to, you know, to pimp your show, the Movie Film Podcast is one of the best movie podcasts out there, and I would recommend that anybody who doesn't already listen, start listening.
And it means a lot.
That's
thank you.
We always love coming here. This is so much fun.
Well, I enjoy having you, so I'm glad. I'm glad that you enjoy coming back, because otherwise, I'd be like, guys, could you come back? No. So I look forward to the next time, and thank you everybody for listening, and we'll catch you next time. Bye bye.
And now, of course, the other thing with a big science fiction fantasy film like this comes the joy of those conventions like Comic Con. Because you all went to Comic Con for this.
Yes, we did. I had not been to one before. I've never seen anything like it. It's absolutely extraordinary.
It is unbelievable.
It really is. But it's wonderful. I mean, to see, it's passion. Seeing people so passionately enthusiastic about, or actually about anything, to see people motivated to that degree, to a sort of pitch of near lunacy, is actually terribly moving. Because the big sort of enemy in this world is sort of apathy or people going, yeah, I don't care. But these are people who care. My God, they care.
Mm. And the oddest thing is it true this Comic-Con was sort of part of your honeymoon?
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yes.
Here's the thing. Now, you know, I got a call. I was on my honeymoon, and they said, this is very important. You have to do it. You know, fly in, please. You have to do it. And, you know, I had to first explain that to my wife, which didn't play well. And then the whole idea of, you know, spending part of your honeymoon with people dressed up like Captain Kirk and Star Wars characters somehow is not easy to explain to your bride, your new bride. But I showed up, and it was, I think you're right, it was really fun because they actually love, they all dress, they love what they do, and it's a very passionate thing. And I've never done a film. Well, I did one film, Batman and Robin, which was a yes.
Oh,
thank you. This was a disaster. But other than that, there's no reason for me to have ever done anything to go to Comic-Con.
But didn't you apologize to the crowd at Comic-Con for Batman and Robin?
I always apologize for Batman. Let me just say that I actually thought I destroyed the franchise until they brought it back. You know, somebody else brought it back years later and changed it. But, you know, I thought at the time this was going to be a very good career move. It wasn't.
But you talk about how the suit was the enemy.
Well, the suit's brutal. You know, at the time, particularly, it weighed, like, I don't know, 60 pounds, and it takes, you know, you have to... there was a director named Joel Schumacher, who's a very funny man, very tall, very sort of eccentric, and he would direct... with a speaker and with a microphone and a speaker. Usually directors will come up and say, hey, he'll be like, okay, and you'd hear this, you know, giant booming voice. And I bolted into this suit, I can't move. And he would literally go, and he would direct you like as if you would have some emotional scene. He would go, okay, people, all right, George, you know, your parents are dead, you have nothing to live for, check.
Fantastic experience for me.